Welcome to True Wealth, your tangible assets advisor. This is Kevin Walter, your host. True Wealth, as always, is brought to you by Coins Plus in Spokane, Washington. Coins Plus is your full-service rare coin and precious metals broker, dealer, and depository service. Obviously, you probably know what most of those terms refer to. Broker, obviously, we find things for people. We've had a number of the most famous expensive coins in existence in our shop, which is kind of weird being where we're at. But that's another story. And we're, of course, a dealer. We have a massive inventory. It's a very, very significant, sizable inventory. And we specialize in helping people build portfolios. I'm personally a very avid collector and investor myself. And so I hand select. You know, we buy many millions of dollars a year and stuff, and I hand select the best of the best for the local clientele and sell the other stuff off in different directions. And so over the years, over a very long period of time, I've built a very substantial inventory of really good material, and we work hard to get that to our investors. It is a little sad once in a while because people don't always appreciate how rare or special some of the stuff that we sell them is, but that's okay. We are, you know, kind of operate as your eyes and ears, I guess, and we have a certain expertise, and that we actually look out for you. We win when you win. We don't win when you know, people lose money or anything like that. We don't have any commission salespeople. Nobody has a financial incentive to maximize profits or anything like that. Most of these companies you deal with do. They have people that survive strictly on commission, and they are typically, well, always going to turn you towards products that they just charge too much for. That's the bottom line. We've seen it for decades, and that's really how I originally got on the air. There's a company called Goldline. You've probably all heard of them, and they have commission salespeople, and they charge exorbitant pricing. And, you know, I've even used their website against them. I've just conversed with them, we'll say. They didn't really like it when I got on the air, but what they do to people financially is not fair, and it's not right. We literally wholesale everything we do to the public, to our clientele, and I mean, even better than wholesale, you know. It's very important to us that we're super fair, that we price things at a level that you are instantly plugged into the market, so that when the market moves, you move. And it's that simple. There's no retail and in our business, or at least at Coins Plus, it's, you know, we're a couple percentage points, and that's about it for the most part. And so, you know, we also buy and sell, I mean, coins, collections, estates, accumulations. If you know, yeah, anybody that's got coins and collections and stuff, send them our way. We are very good at it. We specialize in it. We specialize in wealth and capital preservation. That's just helping you save and store your money in a long-term, consistent, godly, biblical, financial manner. It's interesting, you know, the whole thought process has come to the point where, you know, everybody's tied into the paper system through 401ks, IRAs, things like that. They're just, it's second nature. And if you went back a few generations, they'd think you're nuts. If you go back to, you know, even the 70s and 80s, people would even earlier than that, they buy stock just to get dividends. They would not buy stocks as an entire portfolio. We've seen, if you're in the market, you've probably seen the ups and downs and sideways fluctuations that have gone on, and it gets painful. And I honestly think if you're in equities, mutual funds, things like that, I would get out. I mean, I really would. I would get out, and I would get to into metals. And I think right now the metals are really rolling, and it's a good time to get in. I mean, we are at a 7-year high on the metals, but it's not ridiculous. We're up to 1500 again, and we're seeing just a lot of volatility in the marketplace. And so I would just highly recommend that you Get yourself medals. And that's about as simple as I can put it. You should have a good hedge anyway, because any expert is going to tell you that you need to be balanced. And I mean, I personally do this for a living, and I have probably everything in coins and metals. I know it. But if you don't, you should have a substantial portion for safety. When a market goes up like this and things are really strong like they are, it's a really good time to, save yourself from the imminent drop that's coming. We've got a lot going on in the world right now with China, trade wars, things like that. I really sincerely believe that we are going in the wrong direction. I mean, I support Trump in a big way, but I think there's consequences for certain things that we're doing. And I'm afraid that we're going to see some real downside. There's going to be some kickback, and we've got, the Democrats are, no matter what Donald Trump does, they're not supporting him at all. And when you think about that, that is, like I said last week, the Bible, God says a house divided, well, Jesus said a house divided against itself will fall. And then he said a kingdom divided against itself will fall. And we have a kingdom divided against itself for sure. And I think that just the continuous draining and droning and constant negativity is tearing this country apart. And it's really interesting because obviously I wasn't an Obama fan, but I never spoke about him at the level of disgust and negativity that they're talking about him. It's unbelievable. And I'm just saying, I'm sorry, I'm trying to finish something here. I got that. Let's see here. Okay, but anyway, so let's see. All right. Ooh, okay, thank you for that. Okay, so anyway, we'll get our heads back on here. So basically what we've got going on is an absolute division, and divisiveness at a level. I mean, obviously we can't go back in history. We know about Andrew Jackson, and we know about Hamilton, and we know about, people would have duels and things happen like that. And there was lots of, absolute vehement vitriolic hatred towards one another. But I can't imagine there's ever been a time that's this bad. And the biggest problem in my mind is the media. We have the First Amendment that protects our freedom of speech and religious expression. You and I know they are attacking this at the maximum level. It has to be the worst it's ever been. I can't imagine it's ever been worse. And I'm telling you, it's tearing the country apart, because they have the right to report. And I remember in college, they absolutely pushed for unbiased journalism. They would, spend all this time talking to you and showing you the difference between opinion and fact that's covered up as opinion and opinion that's covered up as fact. And it was absolutely mandatory that journalists and journalism, and at least in college English and stuff, was unbiased. I mean, we would literally have the most left-wing teachers. We had to do journalistic papers where, even the most left-wing teachers would be teaching you to be unbiased. Now, these journalistic education systems, well, the journalistic schools or wherever they're getting it, any school for that matter, unless you send your kids to Hillsdale or something awesome like that, they are brainwashing our kids. They're absolutely turning them against our system. They're tearing the system down. They're complaining. They're droning. They're just constantly speaking garbage and trash against this country. And, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. It's like I said, if you have a country divided among it, against itself, you know, they basically accused Jesus of casting out demons with demons. And he's like, no, that doesn't work. And that's kind of what they're accusing Donald Trump of. The hatred of Trump has just gone so bad. And you've got, you know, today, Andrew Scaramucci or whatever he was that served a whole 11 days in the White House is out there bad-mouthing Trump. And you've got just continuous abusive. You know, I try to look at other channels and listen. And I'm just telling you, folks, you know, we'll just say this. Pray for the country. Let's just say that. We're going through a tough time. We're going through a growing spurt, I guess. Donald Trump, his name Trump, is a biblical name. It's in the Bible. Trump, the definition, is final overriding factor or resource, okay? When he was running and I discovered that, I felt like he's going to win. I just thought, okay, well, that name's not coincidental. It means too much, but it also could be the final opportunity to keep this country on track. And we sincerely, folks, are turning away from God. We've become, you know, I've talked about John Adams' quote that basically says that in order for this republic to survive, we have to have a moral and religious nation. Absolutely have to have it. It's not negotiable. We're losing that. We're turning our backs on God. You know, Trump came out today nicely and, you know, smartly, I guess is a better word. And he's going to deny green cards, green card renewals, and probably green cards for people that come here and go on welfare, right? So what does the Democrats do? The socialists, they yell and bark and moan and complain. I mean, why would we want to import people into this country just to put them on welfare? Because, you know, yes, we have. See, here's the thing. We've got, you know, on the Statue of Liberty, you know, people quote that as if it is the Constitution, okay, where it says, give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shore. Send these, the homeless tempt, toss to me, I left my lamp beside the golden door. And so, you know, this is what Democrats like to quote all the time. Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free. You know, and granted, yeah, you know, if people are being abused and mistreated and they're worn out and life's tough, you know, yeah, I get it. But it's not like, give me your lazy, you know, give me your mooches, give me your socialists, give me your people who are going to trash talk our country and hate it. You know, welfare and social services was set up initially as a short-term solution to the depression and things like that. And it's gone. It's become a lifestyle. There's multi-generational lifestyles. Obama actually made obesity a disability, and families literally raise their kids and teach them to get and be fat in order to remain on welfare. This is how they're raising their children. This is a fact. I watch a documentary on it. It's unbelievable. And so you get the point. I think it's, you know, where are we going? And we've got Trump's trying to do a good job, I really think he's standing up strong. I think he's trying to do a great job. And I think that he's getting picked on, if you could dare. You can't pick on Donald Trump. He's getting lashback. And he, you know, he started it, I suppose. But, yeah, you know, but at the same time, we've lost all respect and dignity in this country, you know. Where they just don't respect the office of president. I mean, literally, I've talked to people that literally blame all of their personal problems on the president of the United States. I mean, it's just like a hate bucket. Now, if someone's directing that kind of vitriol towards somebody, we need to be praying for them. Trump got in office. They've had Bible studies and with the most powerful men in the world and all this kind of stuff. I believe, has become a believer since he got in office. I think he is who he is. He's 70-some years old. He's definitely very verbal. But I also believe that he, I mean, he looks out for evangelicals and born agains big time. He's super Christian, happy, friendly. And so, you know, he's good for us there. One thing I want to talk about that concerns me, well, there's a couple things here that, you know, I want to kind of throw in there when, because we're basically in a time of testing and a time of trial. And even on an individual or a national basis, folks, when you go through hard times, you know, like James says, consider it all joy, my brethren, when you encounter various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces endurance. And let endurance have its perfect result so that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. And then he goes on, if any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask of God, who gives to all generously and without reproach, and it will be given to him. But he must ask in faith, without any doubting. For the one who doubts is like the surf of the sea, driven and tossed by the wind. For that man ought not to expect that he'll receive anything from the Lord. And it goes on, being a double-minded man, unstable in all ways. You know, and but the brother of humble circumstances is to glory in his high position, and the rich man is to glory in his humiliation, because like flowering grass, he will pass away. We just saw that, I don't know if you watched the news, that Epstein guy, billionaire, literal billionaire, dies in prison. They say suicide, I'm not so sure. If you ever saw the Clinton Chronicles and saw all the people that died around him, Bill Clinton, he was, this guy was in jail for having minors, you know, for young teenage girls brought to him from all over the place, and had a lot of people visiting him, a lot of guys. And Clinton said he'd visited him like four times. Well, it turned out it was like 48 times from the logs at the private airport. You know, this Epstein would fly him down, and you can imagine. And Bill Clinton's always had a problem with that. And suddenly Epstein, you know, he's on suicide watch, then he's not, instantly. And then, you know, the cameras were off that day. They're always usually on, but they were off that day. And the guards were supposed to check him every 30 minutes, but they went for hours that day. And, you know, it just, I don't know. I think there's some pretty deep corruption there. You know, it's not good. But basically, he's a rich man. It was a rich, very, very rich man. And he's gone now. And we all die. And it could happen anytime, any day. And we've just got to be prepared to see the Lord. We've got to understand where we stand with him. We've got to, you know, realize that God looks at our heart. We've got to, you know, confess our sins, live for him, and just do everything we can for him each and every day that we're on this earth. And you're going to blow it, and you're going to mess up, and you know, but that's just part of the walk. That's why God gives us time. Hopefully we perfect ourselves and knock the edges off, you know. It's tough stuff. Sometimes life can be pretty tough sometimes. And, you know, God's awaiting us for an eternal existence with him in an absolutely phenomenal, incredible place. And so that's ultimately the prize. And he doesn't really tell us a lot, because I think we'd all be checking out if he did. I spoke last week really rapidly on Friday. I went really fast through David and Goliath on 1 Samuel 17 because I didn't realize how long it was. So, you know, basically the armies of Israel were standing up against the Philistines, and Goliath came out each day and, you know, taunted him and said, take me on. You know, he's nine and a half feet tall. He's carrying 250 pounds of armor and chainmail, as they used to call it, just webbing on of steel, and a spear that was taller than he was, that was made out of solid bronze, that probably weighed a few hundred pounds, and he could chuck that thing. So it's interesting, at least in this day and age, when you see people that tall, they usually have that the pituitary, they have a tumor on their pituitary gland, and it's megalo something, it's, you know, gigantic whatever, giantitis. And that's what we're used to seeing. And back then, I'm sure it was maybe the same, because it's basically a breach of our natural genetics. But this guy, you know, he was not in that way. He was strong as an ox. He was fast. He was tough. He was built. Like I said, I believe God built Goliath for David. And I think God, we all have our Goliaths, don't we? I mean, really, we've all got our challenges and our hurdles we've got to overcome. And I think that's the point of the whole story. And the point is that God loved David's heart. And David wasn't perfect. He was, I think he had a sort of innocence to him. And, you know, we know about Bathsheba and the things that he did. But in general, I think he was just a good-hearted person. And he wanted God's will. And obviously, when he had the affair, if you will, with Bathsheba and killed her husband, I guess that's more than an affair, right? As the king. I mean, super corrupt, right? And when he had that, after a year, he had one of his servants come to him, and they had to use an analogy story that he said, well, you need to take that guy out. And he said, sir, that's you. And he couldn't even see his own sin in his life. And I think we all got to be aware of that. It creeps up on us in different areas, and we get numb to it. And, you know, David had that innocence, and he wanted to seek God, but he still couldn't really see his own sin. Or he was overcome by other emotions that made it not as notable to him. So anyway, so when he's young, his claim to fame, you know, he says, well, I'm jumping around here. The Philistine came forward morning and evening and for 40 days took his stand. And then it says, Jesse said to his son, take now for your brothers. He has him bring food to him. And so David rose early in the morning and left the flock and took the supplies. And he came to the camp, and then he basically saw Goliath come out, the Philistine from Gath named Goliath. He comes out, and every single day he'd come out and defy Israel, okay? And they're like, have you seen this man? The men of Israel said, have you seen this man who's coming up? Surely he's coming to defy Israel, and it goes on. So David spoke to the men who were standing by him. So they had told him, anybody who defeats this guy surely he's coming up to defy Israel, and it will be that the king will enrich the man who kills him with great riches and will give him his daughter and make his father's house free in Israel. Okay, what that means is no taxes, you know, no regulations, nothing. They can do whatever they want. Can you imagine that? I mean, that'd be pretty cool. You could technically sell that. I mean, you could build buildings or whatever, you know, without the, building department and planning commission, I suppose, but we know at least for sure it was to be tax-free and get the daughter and enrich him, okay? So David spoke to the men who were standing by him saying, what will be done for the man who kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should taunt the armies of the living God, he says. And the people answered him in accord with his word, saying, thus it will be done for the man who kills him. So everyone's repeating it to him. He's like, really? Now Eliab, his oldest brother, heard when he spoke to the man, it says, and Eliab's anger burned against David. And he said, why have you come down? And with whom have you left those few sheep in the wilderness? I know your insolence and the wickedness of your heart, for you have come down in order to see the battle. You know, like to watch gore and guts. And I mean, David had no wickedness in his heart at all. In general, we just talked about that. And his brothers hated him when his dad was Jesse. And when, the prophet, Samuel, probably. I don't remember. But when the prophet came to him to anoint him as the future king, he went to the house of Jesse, and he went through 7 boys. And David wasn't even there. And the oil wouldn't run out of the bottle until he said, do you have another son? And the son came in, and then the oil ran. And he knew. And they were like, you know, David was small. The Bible says he was ruddy or redheaded, but it said he was very attractive. And he just wasn't what they expected. He wasn't big. He had brothers that were big and buffed and strong, and he was not. And then so his brothers just chewing him out to zip it, you know, and he says, but David said, what have I done now? Was it not just a question? So he's like, don't I have a right to ask a question? Then he turned away from him to another and said the same thing. And the people answered the same thing as before. So it says that, you know, when David heard or when the words David spoke were heard, they told them to Saul, and he sent for him. David said to Saul, let no man's heart fail on account of him. your servant will go and fight with this Philistine, right? So here's the other thing, too. Well, you'll see this in a minute. Then Saul said to David, you are not able to go against this Philistine to fight with him, for you are but a youth. While he's been a warrior from his youth, David said to Saul, your servant was tending his father's sheep when a lion or a bear, which is kind of a weird way to translate it, and a bear, came and took lambs from my flock, and I went out after them and killed them. And rescued it from his mouth, and when he rose up against me, I seized him by his beard, struck him, and killed him. So David had killed a bear and a lion. I discussed that before. Your servants killed both the lion and the bear, he said, and this uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them, since he has taunted the armies of the living God. And David said, the Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and from the paw of the bear, he'll deliver me from the hand of the Philistine. And Saul said to David, go, and may the Lord be with you. Now, David had complete and total faith, right? And I was just reading in James. It says you ask with believing, and this is something that in my life has become more apparent, is the power of faith. And I just, you know, I kind of was raised in a Christian background that was pretty, you know, platonic, I suppose, or, I mean, not raised, but when I became a believer in Navigators, they're pretty structured, you know, doctrinally firm and correct. And you know, the faith thing kind of was something that I really didn't, you know, buy into. But, you know, it's all over if you believe in all that stuff. And so we've got to, when we approach God, we've got to think big and believe big. I've prayed with people who've had cancer. And a good friend of mine did. And when I found out, he had it a while. And he came in. I said, well, let's go upstairs and let's pray. My wife and I prayed with him. And I prayed for him to be healed. And he's like, ooh, healed. Wow, that's a big prayer. He goes, I said, well, what have you been praying for? He said, I've just been praying for God's will. Well, yeah, well, God, it says, if you delight yourself in the Lord, he'll give you the desires of your heart. He may be testing you to pray those kinds of things and ask those kinds of things and beg him for those things. I mean, it goes down to the point where you'll lose your car keys. I cannot tell you the number of times I lose something silly, and I just pray with complete faith instantly. Boom. It's right there. Oh, okay. He wants you to commune with him consistently. That's why Paul said, pray without ceasing. And God, you know, you build that dialogue, but you also have to listen. You've got to learn to listen to the Lord. But, you know, you get David here. He's blessed by the God. He's anointed. So it says, then Saul clothed David with his garments and put a bronze helmet on his head. He clothed him with armor. David girded his sword over his armor and tried to walk. This is funny. This is a young kid, right? I mean, it's, we don't know, 12, 13. For he had not tested them. So David said to Saul, I can't go with these, for I've not tested them. In other words, you know, I've never done this. And David took them off. He took his stick in his hand and chose for himself 5 smooth stones from the brook, put them in the shepherd's bag, which he had, even in his pouch, and his sling was in his hand, and he approached the Philistine. Now, I'm sure most people understand what the old slings were. They weren't like our slingshots with rubber bands. They were a stick with a big, long rope on it, or that, you know, it's like a slingshot, and it wrapped, you know, it went out in a big loop, and then they'd have like a leather pocket. And it's an art to throw with it. You get tons of leverage, incredible amounts of speed, but it's an absolute athletic feat to control one. I've played with them before, and they're very difficult to control. They come back at you and everything else. You know, you whack yourself up. It's an art, but if you perfect it, they say from some stuff that I was reading that he could realistically have gotten that rock up to 250 miles an hour with a good sling. They've clocked stuff at those speeds, 250 miles an hour, a smooth stone. So it's interesting, you know, David knew exactly what he needed. So anyway, so he took his stick, he chose 5 smooth stones. Then the Philistine came and approached him with a shield bearer in front of him. And when the Philistine looked and saw David, he disdained him, for he was but a youth and ruddy, with a handsome appearance. So he's a good-looking redheaded kid. Philistine said to David, Am I a dog that you come to me with sticks? And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. I know I covered this Friday, but I wanted to cover it a little more in depth. The Philistine also said to David, come to me, and I'll give your flesh to the birds of the sky and the beasts of the field. And David said to the Philistine, you come to me with a sword, a spear, and a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have taunted. This is the way we need to approach life. The devil, temptation, everything. We've got the name of the Lord on our side. We are his children. We are his family. We have the power. You know, the only name given among men by which we must be saved. We have the name of Jesus that shed blood on the cross, the great atoning sacrifice, the almighty creator of the universe. He's on our side. That's, we have to remember and realize who we serve, who we honor, you know, and we've got to make a lordship decision where we put God first. And he's, it's one thing to get saved. Lord, forgive me for my sins, you know, amen. You're saved. Then we need to make a lordship decision. That's to trust in him, to put our faith in him, to realize who he is, to believe in him, as I was saying earlier, belief. I'm not sitting here telling you that I'm the best at this all the time. Faith, I've got. Trust, ouch, right? I love to talk about God. I love to study God, but the trust is super hard. You just want to do everything your own way. So, you know, that's that lordship decision that we all have to make. And so this is apparently, David had an incredible faith. And he'd kill a lion and a bear as a child? I mean, what is this? I mean, he maybe had some neat techniques, but it's not that easy. He says, this day the Lord will deliver you into my hands, and I'll strike you down, remove your head from you. I'll give the dead bodies of the army of, I'll give the dead bodies of the army of the Philistines this day to the birds of the sky and the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know there is a God in Israel. He says back to Goliath, pretty much exactly what Goliath said to him, except he added, I'm going to chop off your head. There's a little tiny boy, probably with a high-pitched voice still, very possibly, maybe hadn't even gone through puberty, you know? And that all this assembly may know, he says, that the Lord does not deliver by sword or spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he'll give you into our hands. The battle is the Lord's. That's what I was just talking about. I'm telling you, it's this Holy Spirit. We've got to live that way, and it's tough sometimes. We want to do things on our own. Some are more prone to that than others. Then it happened when the Philistine rose and came and drew near to meet David, that David ran quickly toward the battle line to meet the Philistine. No fear there, right? Complete courage. David put his hand into his bag and took from it a stone and slung it and struck the Philistine in his forehead. The stone sank into his forehead so that he fell on his face on the ground. And that's where I was doing some reading. This stone, they estimate, would have had to been traveling over 200 miles an hour in order to sink in like that. I mean, that's just the fact. And so he had the skill, and that was a, you know, basically like a slow moving bullet. So David put his hand to his bag and took from it a stone. So he knocks the guy. It sinks into his forehead. David prevails over the Philistine with a sling and a stone, and he struck the Philistine and killed him, and he didn't have a sword. So he ran, stood over the Philistine, and took his sword and drew it out of its sheath and killed him. So he wasn't dead yet, and he cut off his head. That's how I ended the show last week. When the Philistines saw that their champion was dead, they fled. So the men of Israel and Judah arose and shouted and pursued the Philistines as far as the valley and to the gates of Ekron, and the slain Philistines lay along the way to Sharam, even to Gath and Ekron. The sons of Israel returned from chasing the Philistines and plundered their camps. Then David took the Philistine's head and brought it to Jerusalem, but he put his weapons in his tent. I'm not sure about that. Now, when Saul saw David, Saul, right, the king, going out against the Philistine, he said to Abner, the commander of the army, Abner, whose son is this young man? And Abner says, by your life, O king, I don't know. Now, this is interesting because David, prior to this, had been serving Saul as a harp player because Saul had, it said, had been given, he'd being tormented or terrorized, it said, by an evil spirit from the Lord. I'll go back and read that. So David had been, and he'd called David in. The only thing that would make the evil spirit go away was David playing the harp. So he'd been serving Saul. Saul had sent to his father Jesse and said, I have your son, basically. You don't get him back. He's going to be serving me. And Saul still doesn't know who he is. So that you talk about a level of arrogance, you know, in a distance, in a lack of camaraderie, or, you know, respect for the servants, I suppose, the peasants. The king said, you inquire whose son the youth is. So when David returned from killing the Philistine, Abner took him and brought him before Saul with the Philistine head in his hand. Saul said to him, whose son are you, young man? David answered, I am the son of your servant Jesse the Bethlehemite. And it's interesting because if I jump back here to 16, So David gets anointed by Samuel, and, you know, to be the next king, and they keep it a secret. But Samuel knew. Samuel went searching for him. God sent him there. And then it says, okay, we go up, and we're in 16. It's talking about your servants, a skillful player on the harp shall come it's this evil spirit. I got to find where it says this. So he brought him in, blah, blah, blah. Let's see. Sorry, guys. Let our Lord now command your servants who are before you, let them seek a skillful, seek a man who is a skillful player on the harp, and it shall come about when the evil spirit from God is on you that he shall play the harp with his hand. And so Saul said to his servants, provide for me now a man who can play well and bring him to me. Then one of the young men said, behold, I have seen the son of Jesse the Bethlehemite, who's a skillful musician, a mighty man of valor, a warrior, one prudent in speech and a handsome man. And the Lord is with him. So Saul sent messengers to Jesse and said, send me your son David, who is with the flock. Jesse took a donkey loaded with bread and wine and a young goat and sent them to Saul by David his son. Then David came to Saul and attended him, and Saul loved him greatly, and he became his armor bearer. Saul sent to Jesse, saying, let David now stand before me, for he has found favor in my sight. So it came about, whenever the evil spirit from God came to Saul, David would take the harp and play it with his hand, and Saul would be refreshed and be well, and the evil spirit would depart from him. So Saul, I mean, why didn't he know who David was? I mean, that's one thing. I just think it might be that arrogance or blindness or, you know, the evil spirit, or who knows. But and then what happens shortly after this is basically they're walking through the city. I don't need to read it to you, but it says Saul became very angry. So the women sang as they played, as David's walking through. It said it happened as they were coming when David returned from killing the Philistine that the women came out of all the cities of Israel singing and dancing to meet King Saul with tambourines, with joy, and with musical instruments. So they're just cheering. I mean, this is a big day. This is a great day. It's awesome, right? The women sang as they played and said, now this is where it's going to get problematic. The women sang as they played and said, Saul has slain his thousands and David his 10,000s. Then it says, Saul became very angry, for this saying displeased him, and he said, they have ascribed to David 10,000s, but to me they've ascribed thousands. Now, what more can he have but the kingdom? Saul looked at David with suspicion from that day on. Okay? So he's paranoid. You know, this is another situation where God, like with the Pharaoh, you know, God basically, he hardened the Pharaoh's heart. God put an evil spirit on Saul, not just to make this story, but it's wonderfully worked out. But we reap what we sow. So he was living evil before this. It's not like he just took a great guy and said, here, I'm going to dump an evil spirit on him. He gave up on this guy. This guy had turned his back on him, probably incredibly arrogant, and on it goes. I mean, it just gets crazy. It's an absolutely incredible story. So you've basically got Saul turning against David. It says, now it came about in the next day that an evil spirit from God came mightily upon Saul. Now that's interesting, isn't it? And he raved in the midst of the house while David was playing the harp with his hand as usual, and a spear was in Saul's hand. Saul hurled the spear, for he thought, I will pin David to the wall. I mean, he's turned on David, right? There's a little jealousy problem here. But David escaped from his presence twice, it says. David was, you can imagine, drop that harp and run, boy. And he did. Now, Saul was afraid of David, for the Lord was with him, but the Lord had departed from Saul. Let's just hope none of us ever experience that. God, you know, he says he'll turn us over to a reprobate heart. Lord, I, you know, pray that I do not ever experience that. Sincerely. Therefore, Saul removed from him from his presence and appointed him as the commander of 1,000, and he went out and came before the people. David was prospering in all his ways, for the Lord was with him. I'm in 18, 1 Samuel now. When Saul saw he was prospering greatly, he dreaded him. And we all know the rest of the story. But it's interesting. So, you know, Saul gives him his daughter, for Saul thought, my hand shall not be against him, but let the hand of the Philistines be against him. But David said to Saul, who am I, and what is my life or my father's family in Israel, that I should be the king's son-in-law? So it came about at that time, then Merab, Saul's daughter, should have been given to David, that she was given to Adriel, the Maholathite, for a wife. So David didn't take the daughter, which, you know, good for him, I suppose. So then it was now Michal, Saul's daughter, you know, loved David. When they told Saul the thing was agreeable to him, Saul thought, I'll give her to him that she may become a snare and the hand of the Philistines may be against him. Therefore, Saul said to David, for a second time, you may be my son-in-law today. Then Saul commanded his servants, speak to David secretly. Tell him, behold, the king delights in you and all his servants love you. Now, therefore, become the king's son-in-law. So Saul's servants spoke these words to David, but David said, is it trivial in your sight to become the king's son-in-law, since I'm a poor man and lightly esteemed, etc., right? So David just, he won't go for it. And then basically what happens, as you're all aware, is Saul just turns deeper and deeper against David and then gets to the point where he pursues him and relentlessly. And it's just a really incredible story about God and David's faith and strength and courage. And you know the story where David snuck in the cave when Saul was sleeping and left basically a sign that he'd been there to let him know that he had no malice, etc. And it teaches us a lot of things about how we live our lives and how we approach other people, even when they're pursuing us, etc. So that is that, and that is a really awesome story. I think we can get a lot out of that. I think we can all... It's symbolic of each little quip is symbolic of choices we make in life. I mean, I think we can all relate to each and every one of those choices that David was making and opportunities he was given. And we've got to be the same. We've got to be that way in our lives. We've got to look for, you know, those godly responses to everything that comes our way. So here we are. Couple things. One thing that's really on my heart right now, we've had the shootings here recently. And so what happens every time we get shootings? We get gun control, right? So I'm going to be honest with you. So the answer, there is 300 million guns currently in circulation in America, is the most recent number I've heard. Whether it's true or not, I can't tell you, but they say there is, and that's that. So you can't take them away. We've got the Second Amendment, okay? Why was the Second Amendment made? The Second Amendment to the Constitution, in the Bill of Rights, if you're not familiar. It was passed by Congress September 25th of 1789. That was one of the first things to go through. It was ratified December 15th of 1791. The first 10 amendments are what form the Bill of Rights. And it's the phraseology is a well-regulated militia being necessary to security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed, period. Okay? So we've got a lot going on in this country already that is breaching that, okay? The militia, the concept of the militia is basically what the Air National Guard is to every state now, and they've become, you know, gun control is much a part of the Second Amendment as the right to keep and bear arms. The gun control concept was not new. I mean, this is weaponry they wanted to take away. The biggest problem that we have now is that our government is so much more armed than we are. So the reason that they created this amendment, or the Second Amendment, was very simple. In the founding generation, they believed that governments are prone to use soldiers to oppress the people. English history showed them that this risk could be controlled by permitting the government to raise armies consisting of full-time paid troops only when needed to fight foreign adversaries. That's how we started out. We would pay armies when we need them. For other purposes, such as responding to sudden invasions or other emergencies, the government could rely on a militia that consisted of ordinary civilians who supplied their own weapons and received some part-time unpaid military training. That's how we started out. So the onset of war does not always allow time to raise and train an army, and the Revolutionary War showed that militia forces couldn't be relied on for national defense. So the Constitutional Convention decided that the federal government should have almost unfettered authority to establish peacetime standing armies and regulate the militia. So the massive shift of power from the states to the federal government generated one of the chief objections to the proposed Constitution. So they had the Anti-Federalists who argued that the proposed Constitution was taking from the states the principal means of defense against federal usurpation, which is essentially tyrannical government. They knew it. That's what the Second Amendment was all about. No one will tell you that now. You get the liberals will deny it, but that's the bottom line. The Federalists responded that fears of federal oppression were overblown. Of course, Federalists, you know, their government. I mean, it's kind of the seed group of communism or socialism, I suppose. And they had all this faith, probably less godly men, to be honest with you. So they thought that was overblown, in part because the American people were armed and would be almost impossible to subdue through military force. Then we have to go on and ask ourselves, how much imagination or foresight did the founding fathers have? I know George Washington had all kinds of visions of the future. Did they know that how complex weaponry would get? I suppose they probably did. And, you know, did they know that the government would get to the point where they just had unlimited resources? I don't think so. And that's not what this government was ever designed. You know, we have the Federal Reserve and we pump all this cash. I mean, just alone from the creation of the Federal Reserve till the end of FDR's reign, if you will, our government grew 1,000-fold. Actually, during the reign of FDR, our government grew 1,000-fold. That's how fast it grew. He was a major, major socialist, of course, glorified by the liberals to this day in extreme. But he got us going that way, and we're still paying the price. I mean, that's the road we're on. Once you implement that stuff, you can't stop. Once the borrowing and the debt gets out of control, that's where we're at. That's why you need metals, to be honest with you. You've got to be hedged. You know, there's when they're, you know, times look okay and whatnot, you know, they're not as exciting. But, you know, when times get tough, you got to have something to back you up. So the proposed new constitution gave the federal government total legal authority over the militia. And the Federalists and Anti-Federalists, they had two assumptions. That one was the constitution would give the federal government total legal authority over the army and militia. And second, that the federal government would not have any authority at all to disarm its citizens. They agreed only about whether an armed populace could adequately deter federal oppression. So basically, their debate wasn't if they could ever take guns. It was whether the people could defend the country, you know? So the Second Amendment conceded nothing to the Anti-Federalist desire to sharply curtail the military power of the federal government, which would have required substantial changes in the original Constitution. But the amendment was easily accepted because of widespread agreement that the federal government should not have the power to infringe the right of the people to keep and bear arms any more than it should have the power to abridge the freedom of speech or prohibit our free exercise of our religion. So obviously everything, you know, is considerably different since 1791. The traditional militia fell, long ago, and the state-based militia organizations were eventually incorporated into the federal military structure, which is the Air National Guard. And the nation's military establishment has become enormously more powerful than 18th century armies, as I was talking earlier. You know, we still hear all this political rhetoric about the federal tyranny, but most Americans don't fear the nation's armed forces, and virtually no one thinks that an armed populace, in other words, citizenry, could defeat those forces in battle. No, everyone knows we wouldn't even stand a chance. Furthermore, 18th century civilians routinely kept at home the very same weapons they would need if called to serve in the militia. So while modern soldiers are equipped with weapons that differ significantly from what they call appropriate for civilian use, civilians no longer expect to use their household weapons for militia duty, although they still keep and bear arms to defend against common criminals, as well as for hunting and other forms of recreation. And that's where things, you know, the laws have changed. The states in the founding era regulated guns. Blacks weren't allowed to have guns, and, you know, and militia weapons were registered on government rolls. Gun laws today are more extensive and controversial. Another important legal development was the adoption of the 14th Amendment. The Second Amendment originally applied only to the federal government, leaving the states to regulate weapons as they saw fit. Each state was like a separate nation, technically. They had a lot of sovereignty. Anything outside of the Bill of Rights. Although there is substantial evidence that the privileges or immunities clause of the 14th Amendment was meant to protect the right of individuals to keep and bear arms from infringement by the states. And then in 1876, the Supreme Court rejected it. And on it goes. I was just kind of going through a checklist of stuff here. But essentially what's going on, then in 2010, the Supreme Court struck down a similar handgun ban at the state level. I go down these things. And, you know, we four justices relied on judicial precedents under the 14th Amendment's Due Process Clause. Justice Thomas rejected those precedents in favor of reliance on the Privileges or Immunities Clause, but all five members of the majority concluded the 14th Amendment protects against state infringement of the same individual right that is protected from federal infringement by the Second Amendment. So, I'll read you the 14th Amendment here real quick. That's where the debate came in. It says, all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the U.S. and of the state wherein they reside. No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the law. So essentially it's saying states cannot override. It's really stupid. It's obvious. It's just saying they can't make laws that override the Constitution, and they cannot deprive you of your life, liberty, or property. You know, we always hear life, liberty, pursuit of happiness. It was originally written as the life, liberty, and ownership of property. And they chose not to word it that way originally because of the slaves. They didn't want to offend them. And later on, they basically came back with the 14th Amendment and they added that back in. They added the original verbiage that they wanted in the Constitution to specifically talk about property. Property was very, very important. It was 1868. This is right after the Civil War. You know, you can imagine. I mean, states were, you know, disarming people and, oh, you fought for the South, and so we're going to, you know, come and ransack your house, burn it down, and take your weapons. There was a lot of stuff going on back then. It was pretty dirty. A lot of people died. There was a lot of bad blood. So, you know, without further ado, the bottom line is our founders made, you know, the liberals will try to cast out the founders is white, bigoted, slave owner, racist. And you know what? Not true. But even if it was, it doesn't matter. We live in a country with a constitution. And the constitution makes darn good sense. And we have got to fight to protect our arms. We've got, because without it, you know, there's a list. I went through a list here recently, and I didn't even bring it on the show because there's so many countries that have disarmed their citizens. I couldn't even believe, I didn't even know the name of 90% of them, really. And it's always the precursor to complete tyrannical dictatorships or takeover or slaughters, etc. It's always the precursor is the disarmament of the people. Absolutely not something, you know. So when we start with gun control, it's like, or these federal background checks, right? Well, so what do they look for first? Okay, mental illness. We'll define that. You go to a doctor one day and he says you're mentally ill, you're done. That's it. You know? bipolar, you know, or hyperactivity or what, you know? And then they start to encompass and include, what are they going to call being a spiritual person, a Christian, a delusionary mindset? You know, it's coming. The hatred towards, you know, followers of Jehovah, God, are hated by the left. And so you open up. It all sounds good when it starts. It's like the first year income taxes came into this nation, which, by the way, are also forbidden in the Constitution and overridden by the 16th Amendment. But the first year, what was it? It was a voluntary 0.5% of any income over $20,000. That was when $20,000 was like $2 million. So they always start out like that. I was communicating with somebody a little bit about the Trump thing, and you know, they've basically, you know, obsoleted all state and local sales and income tax deductions on the federal level. And, you know, when people spend a lot on – they make a lot of money, they spend a lot on sales tax, right? And so it doesn't affect the smaller people or the lower income, and they're always like, ah, who cares, that person up there. You know, I've talked to people that are totally pro 70% tax and all. They don't get it. They think, well, those guys make so much money. What's the difference? The difference is it creeps down. First of all, tax basis has not changed in like 40 years. In other words, the cutoffs for income tax percentages has not changed. So, you know, $25,000 at this level was $25,000 40 years ago. And people, so the tax levels were for way, way, way up the ladder. Now they're just general everyday people. So over time, we have literally a progressive tax, okay? So it's just important to understand all the constitutional stuff. I think it's really important to understand where we stand on these rights. And I think you gotta educate yourself, educate your neighbor, talk to your friends, and pray for this nation. We've got to be praying, praying, praying. This nation needs it now more than ever. We're wounded. We're divided drastically. We're seeing violence everywhere, you know, and it's not over. I was going to say real quick, I don't have a lot of time, but the solution, in my opinion, is more guns. People be like, oh, you're crazy. No, we need armed citizens. I've discussed this. We need like an Arm America movement where people can get certified to carry guns at certain levels in certain places, and they could have a federal educational program, and I'd love to see that. But that's my theory. Taking them away, then just the bad guys have them. You've all heard it before. Thank you for tuning in. I appreciate it. Appreciate your support. You can call Coins Plus 444-0044 in Spokane, and we'd love to help you out. Take care. God bless, and thanks again. Bye-bye.